freedom, and grace be with you. My name is John Clifton. Welcome to another episode of Hard Fire. This one is a follow-up to a previous discussion regarding the tax code and people's obligations or non-obligations thereof. The previous program had as guests the tax honesty author Peter Hendrickson and a tax preparer named Audrey Desard. We hope to have both of them back today, but for some reason Desard was not able to make this episode. But we do have Peter Hendrickson on the line, and I'd like to hear Peter say hello.
Hello, John. Hello, all.
Yes. I'm glad you're with us. And the topic today was going to be at least an overview of the issue of wages versus income in the as construed by various people in the tax on the tax issue. Mr. Sartre was going to defend the position that all income is income, therefore everyone is obligated to pay income taxes. Your position was going to be, and is, I understand, a different one, namely that wages are exempt from the category or the definition of income, or am I incorrect?
Let me clarify that, John. It's important to draw a distinction between the legal term wages, which is a custom-defined term within the revenue law, mm-hmm. and wages, as people tend to think of that word, meaning earnings for work. Mm-hmm. Earnings for work don't necessarily constitute income, as that term is meant in the law.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, don't constitute something taxable. They don't reflect the engagement in a taxable activity. Wages, on the other hand, when speaking in the context of the Internal Revenue Laws, mean nothing but the custom-defined term that is spelled and pronounced the same way, and that is exclusively remuneration paid to federal officers and employees, and consequently is indeed income representative of engaging in a taxable activity, and is subject to the income tax.
Oh, so let me clarify a couple things here. When you're going by that definition, as you say, Internal Revenue definitions go, is that a consequence of people consenting to be employees, federal employees, by working for the federal government, by actually working there, or by filling out a form that basically creates a presumption that they are the employees? Are you saying that the definition is a binding definition in the law on everybody?
It's a binding definition of the law. The law is perfectly explicit about it. It defines wages as remuneration paid to employees and defines employees as officers, employees, or elected officials of the United States, a state or any political subdivision thereof, or the District of Columbia, or any agency or instrumentality of any one or more of the foregoing. And by the way, when the term state is used in this language, state is also a custom-defined mm-hmm. term in the law. It does not mean Ohio. It means what it means according to this provision of the law.
Mm-hmm.
Applicability of administrative provisions. All provisions of the laws of the United States applicable to the assessment and collection of any tax imposed by this title or of any other liability arising under this title, including penalties, shall, in respect of such tax or liability, extend to and be applicable in any possession of the United States mm-hmm. in the same manner and to the same extent as if such possession were a state of the United States, and that means belonging to the United States. The United States, in and of itself, being a custom-defined term, we get kind of layer after layer here.
Now, when you say custom-defined term, is that equivalent to what some people more who are critical of the way certain of these laws and rules are written, the term words of art?
Words of art, indeed, yes.
Yeah, so it's a term that's been customarily redesigned or engineered to mean something that's advantageous to what the IRS wants.
And it is advantageous because these terms, these words of art, amount to homonyms for words that are in common usage mm-hmm. and which have completely contrary meanings. The meaning of the word of art version in the code has a similar meaning in this sense. An employee in the code, while it is confined to a certain class of people who work for other people, mm-hmm. it still means people who work for other people. And so the relationship there is a very nuanced distinction between people who work for other people mm-hmm. as a general class and people who work for other people within the federal government.
And just to make this clear to the average person here who might, this has already gone over their heads, the words of art mean is that when a person reads anything or hears anything, they're thinking that the meaning of the words are what the regular people understand those meanings to be, or at least the dictionary definition of those words.
That's correct.
And they're not aware or keeping cognizant of the fact that there could be very specific meanings within the legal context for those same words and terms defined by regulators or defined by the courts that take the meaning of those words or same phrases into an entirely different zone.
That's exactly right. Yes, anytime something issues forth from a tax agency that uses the word employee, that word that has to be presumed to be the term employee as defined in the law, which does not mean simply somebody who works for somebody else. It means exclusively an elected official or employee of the federal government, which is how that term is defined in the law.
Yeah.
Anytime they use the term wages, they're not talking about earnings for labor or earnings for work. They're talking about remuneration paid to an employee as we defined it a moment ago. And
so,
nothing else.
So this is what part of what, well, again, a lot of us critical people of the tax system call the something like the tax fraud begins to arise. A person fills out commonly a W-4 when they go to work, and the form says employee on it. For you use one such term, and they're thinking employee means they're working, the person they're working for in the private
right.
sector. Whereas, in terms of what's legally binding, that's embodied in that term is you're agreeing that you are an employee of the federal government.
That's exactly correct. Those forms are only intended to be filled out by that certain class of worker, that's a federal employee. And the law is very clear about this. The amazing thing is that while you make reference to a fraud, and it is very nearly a constructive fraud, at least, in that it is widely known, widely understood, that most people have no idea of these distinctions and these nuances, and the beneficiaries of the tax system make no effort to clue them in, none whatsoever. In fact, they bend over backwards to not clue them in, and this is demonstrated by the fact that, for instance, the definitions that of these terms are never included with documents that are sent to companies across America instructing
right.
them to do this and that regarding their employees, or to do this and that regarding wages that they paid. When a company receives a notice of that sort, it doesn't say, and by the way, the wages we're talking about are defined as this. They never say that. They rely on a legal principle, which is that the party responding to a legal requirement is expected to know the limits of that requirement or to seek them out. It is incumbent upon them. It's their responsibility to know the legal limits of the thing that they're dealing with. And so they can sit back and say, well, we didn't exactly lie to them. I mean, we didn't command them to do this in regard to their workers. We only told them to do it in regard to their employees. And they're supposed to know that when we're talking employee, we mean federal officers and employees.
Now, of course, this would never be tolerated if the private sector misled constructively.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Absolutely. It's kind of like what happened to Ponzi as compared to what happens in the Social Security system, the way it tends to be administered.
One is the government program, retirement program, they say, and the other is a scam.
Yeah, the other guy ended up in prison.
Yeah. And even though I think at the end he returned 40% of people's money that he
destroyed.
I believe
he did.
And that might be more than what a lot of Social Security retirees
get in the future. I don't expect to see that much.
Yeah. So the upshot of all this, for people who are trying to follow, is now this is where we have points of agreement and then they veer into points of disagreement. A person who then is filing these forms, I keep starting to say 10-4, but I mean W-4 and 1099s and et cetera, W-9s, where they're creating a presumption by filing that form that they are under the categories defined in that form that they've signed, and therefore they've made themselves subject to payment of exposure and subject and liability to income taxes.
I would say that they have furnished support for the presumption that they belong to a certain class that is subject to certain laws. I would disagree with the proposition that they have actually made themselves legally subject. I have filled out W-4s before, and when I do, I am doing it on this basis. I am saying that if indeed it should prove to be the case at some point in the future, due to some idiosyncrasy of some work that I do at some point, perhaps even unbeknownst to me, that I actually am paid wages as defined in the law and to which this form is connected or properly applies, then this is how I want it to be treated. And but the responsibility for determining whether that's actually happened is up to the person that is going to act on this information. I'm not saying that what I get paid is going to constitute wages. Absolutely not. It would be ridiculous for me to say that. I don't work for the federal government.
No.
But since I've been asked to fill this form out, it is a prospective submission. It is, and okay, you're sort of suggesting that at some point maybe I would get paid wages from you. Well, if it should prove to be true, then here's how I want them. Here's the number of deductions that I want to apply, and here's how I want the exemptions to work. So it's a prospective thing, kind of an if then.
Now, just to summarize, one of the major benefits of people that are in store for people if they get your book and you're free to state the name and whereabouts of where to get it and whatever. How do you undo this this process of providing and furnishing evidence that creates a presumption?
Well, here's the way the system works. People who pay other people in this country have been encouraged, intimidated, fooled, and everything just short of defrauded into engaging in a practice of creating affidavits, legal declarations, alleging the payment of a taxable thing. And I'm going to draw a quick distinction here, or make a quick explanation, and then I'm going to abandon it for the rest of our conversation,
right,
because it's really clunky, but it's important that people understand that the income tax is not on the money, even if that money is related to the taxable activity. The tax is on a taxable activity. It's an excise tax on the privilege of exercising a government prerogative and profiting thereby. And so the money is just the thing we measure the amount of activity engaged in by. So we're going to continue. I'm going to continue to refer to the money as being the income, but what it really means is the money is the measure of the taxable activity that was engaged in. So leaving that aside. So what people do when they pay other people, they are then encouraged to create these affidavits saying that the money they paid was actually income, as that term is legally meant. In other words, it is a reflection of a taxable activity, therefore a tax can arise from it.
Right.
Now, the system recognizes that those allegations can often be made incorrectly, and it provides mechanisms for those about whom these allegations have been made to correct the record, to respond and rebut and correct erroneous affidavits. And those mechanisms take several different forms.
I'm going to have to stop you there so we're going to go right back to what forms and procedures are in place to correct this. But first, I want to do my normal plug for the activity of the Libertarian Party in New York. As you can tell here, you're hearing information you're not going to necessarily hear anywhere else other than by following programs like Hardfire, which present to you various perspectives on liberty and the basis for those freedoms that we advocate for New York and for the rest of the nation. I encourage you to go to and explore the activity of the Manhattan LP, which meets at the Ukrainian East Village restaurant every month, or I think the second Wednesday. Go to manhattanlp.org to get their activity. Queens County has an active party, meets in Astoria every month. You're encouraged to go to lpqc.org to find out more details about their activity. And the state is, in fact, very active indeed. And we hope you look at newyork.lpny.lp.org to find out about the state move activity on behalf of liberty in New York State. Our guest again is Mr. Hendrickson, and he's in the middle of explaining. It's a bit of elaborate, but it's required. I hope audience patience can hold up here while you go into what form or procedure is necessary, or at least in your system, in order to undo the damage, I think, created by the typical forms people file when they are beginning
right,
to work.
The information return, such as W-2s, 1099s, K-1s, etc. And it's not my system now. This is Congress's system. But Congress has provided, as it must, just for the sake of due process, mechanisms for responding to allegations that are incorrect. Basically, a person has three different ways they can respond to an allegation, other than just ignoring it, which in and of itself is a response of a sort. It's an affirmative response. They can acknowledge those allegations. They can correct those allegations to the degree that they're wrong, or they can rebut them entirely to the degree that, you know, in a case in which they're entirely wrong. When an information return like a W-2 or a 1099 is produced, it says two things. It says company A has paid this person both this amount of money, and this amount of money is being legally declared to have been received due to the engaging in a taxable activity. In other words, it is income. One or both of those things can be right. One or both of those things can be wrong. And so the Congress has provided mechanisms for responding to those allegations. There's a reason. In fact, this is the reason why people are sent a copy of these forms. And it is not just to let them know what numbers to put on their tax return. It's to give them notice that allegations have been made about them, allegations with a legal implication, and to which they are entitled to respond.
Okay. I think this would take maybe too long to just go into in terms of explaining all the parts of the...
I'll cut to the chase. A 1040 is one of the chief mechanisms for responding to these allegations and correcting them.
Yes.
It is the means by which a filer introduces his or her own testimony into the record about their receipts and says either, yes, these receipts were gained in this amount and did constitute income, or no, they did not. And so that's one of the mechanisms that Congress provides, or the Treasury Department anyway, provides for people to respond to allegations. There are also several other forms that are specifically intended to correct or rebut erroneous information returns directly. For instance, there's a form 4852, which is specifically intended to correct erroneous W-2s.
Yep.
If someone has received a W-2 that has bad information on it, either an incorrect amount or that the amount is paid at all, that it is incorrect.
All right. I use 4852s and a specialized form, a 1040-NR based on Chris Hansen, another tax honesty advocate, in order to undo these misimpressions. Not necessarily your system, because I hadn't been aware of your Pacific book at the time I did this. But that through the method through which I have been avoiding or basically responding to and to this erroneous trail of evidence that was created, and basically declaring independence of this tax fraud system, as I call it.
Sure.
I just want to get back to the income versus wage question again, because one part of it may have went over the public's head in that you mentioned that the law is established that you know what the definition of income is and wages, but you didn't discuss the possible conflict between what the IRS documents and publications and titles, codes, whatever say versus what the courts have said and what the courts have decided in the case law on the matter of wages versus income.
Well, I've yet to see any case law in which a court has declared non-federally related earnings to constitute income directly. There have been many cases in which litigants or defendants have failed to argue this case effectively, and rulings which kind of seem to suggest that sort of a conclusion are produced by the IRS. But those rulings tend to typically say things along the line of, well, of course wages are income. You know, the defendant argues that his wages aren't income. That's simply not true. Well, I agree. That simply is not true. In the context of the tax law, wages are always income. The problem is failing to recognize that that earnings are not always wages in the context of the tax law.
Okay, well, that gets a little more hairy a distinction. Let me just read you the language of some key sentences from some Supreme Court decisions, like Clark versus U.S. Quote, of course, gross income and not gross receipts is the foundation of income tax liability. For it is only earnings, profits, and gains which the statute subject to tax, unquote. Or another decision, Edwards versus Deith. The statute and the statute alone determines what is income to be taxed. It taxes only income derived from many different specified sources. One does not derive income by rendering services and charging for them, which I believe a phrase would cover off versions of labor and working out of one labor
and
personal
and
effort.
If I could throw one in, United States Supreme Court, South Pacific v. Lowe.
Yeah.
We must reject the broad contention submitted on behalf of the government that all receipts, everything that comes in, are income.
Right. Basically, I think the IRS wants receipts to be interpreted as income, and
sure.
The decisions say no, receipts, that is those proof of that people have worked and had made personal efforts and made gotten a commission or whatever, is not the same thing as a profit. Like if you put up $1,000 in a stock and the stock grows $100 in value, you've earned $100 in income. That's income under most everybody's understanding of law and
As long as it was a federal corporation.
Yeah.
There's no question that the IRS would like everyone to imagine that income means all that comes in, and there's no question that the courts have repeatedly said income is a specialized class of receipts. It does not mean all that comes in. And in fact, it can't mean all that comes in because to tax all that comes in would be to tax in the form of a capitation.
Mm-hmm.
And capitations are specifically prohibited constitutionally, not once, but twice. In fact, the only thing in the Constitution that is prohibited twice. In fact, it's the only thing that's mentioned twice in the Constitution.
Right.
The founders were very serious about ensuring that capitations did not exist in America. In fact, if you'll indulge me, I'd like to read the definition of capitation.
All right.
Can I go with that?
Yes.
The taxes which, it is intended, should fall indifferently upon every different species of revenue are capitation taxes. Capitation taxes, if it is attempted to proportion them to the fortune or revenue of each contributor, become altogether arbitrary. The state of a man's fortune varies from day to day, and without an inquisition more intolerable than any tax, and renewed at least once every year, doesn't that sound familiar, can only be guessed at. Capitation taxes, as far as they are levied upon the lower ranks of people, are direct taxes upon the wages of labor. And when I say wages here, this is written in 1776. It does not mean wages in the sense of the definition in the Internal Revenue Code that hadn't been written and wouldn't be for another 150 years, and are attended with all the inconveniences of such taxes.
Yeah. All right. So I understand. Well, I'm not going to say I understand every word of that because I just heard you read it off for the first time. But I do understand the flow of the argument. I just want to go back to one other element here, that when we're talking about what's written in the tax code and versus what else is binding on everybody versus binding on some people, one of the things to keep in mind that is a little specialized thing is that it's the distinction between positive law, the regular law that is binding on everybody, versus special law, which comes from granting one's consent to a privilege.
Right.
I have a language from a letter from the IRS, which explained this definition. The Internal Revenue Code, quote, is not positive law or the regular law. It is special law. It applies to specific persons in the United States who choose to make themselves subject to the requirements of the special laws in the Internal Revenue Code by entering into an employment agreement within the U.S. government, unquote.
Joan Hoverell letter.
Yes, there it is. And that clarifies things pretty much from the IRS's mouth itself, or at least one of their mouths. And I think it's one of the reasons why it's very hard to get the IRS on record.
They do tend to dodge questions, don't they?
Yes. And
however, they do respond well to my readers, John. My readers have so far recovered several $1 million in previously withheld amounts, which includes amounts that were garnished from them, amounts that had been levied from them.
Yeah.
We have liens canceled. I just saw for the first time in my life, after some 27 years now of involvement in this subject, for the first time I saw a case closed to a notice of deficiency that was received by one of my readers. On my website at lostrisons.com, I have currently posted more than $750,000 in refund checks received by readers over the course of the last 18 months.
Marvelous. And of course, last year you had two victories, I believe, in court when the courts, the IRS or whomever tried to call you one of these illegal tax scam situations.
Three times, actually.
All right. And they, you know, they went to court and they tried to shut you down and all that. And what was the outcome?
The outcome was the Department of Justice asking to be let drop their actions without my demanding my costs from them, which mm-hmm. I was gracious enough to grant.
Yeah. And I believe that's a better track record than some other people in the tax honesty movement.
I think it's unique, actually, in the tax honesty.
In general, what I've observed is that it seems like those who try to directly argue or force an answer from the government get stonewalled, and if they try to do it in the context of their own personal tax trial, they get hammered by it because the judge can always just shut down their attempt to introduce arguments about the law and side with the IRS, effectively. Whereas those such as yourself who have emphasized what the statutes say and stuck to the facts in the administrative process have fared much better.
Yes.
And I think that might be the direction of the future movement. Your approach, I would personally opine, has a lot to say to go for in terms of simplicity. If a person just goes through the steps, they don't have to learn about all these myriad issues and definitions and words of art. We have about 1 minute to go. Could you maybe say in like 30 seconds explain any other or just summarize your point of view and its basis?
Well, yeah, it's simple. Income is the exercise of federal prerogative and measured by the benefit received for its exercise. Mm-hmm. It's a very simple proposition. It involves ownership. The government is entitled to tax something that it has an ownership interest in or a property interest in, and it certainly has a property interest in its own powers mm-hmm. and its own property, and it applies the tax accordingly. Everything about this is clear in the law. It's simply deeply hidden
mm-hmm.
In statutory language that amounts to many millions of words, and it is not made to be easy to take in. And it simply requires a lot of digging, a lot of research to get to the fine print. But the fine print is there.
And you've done it, so the rest of us don't have to.
On that
note, I have to say I'm sorry we're out of time. I could have gone another half hour with this or an hour, but we can't.
Very pleasure, Don.
Join us again for another exciting episode of Hard Fire.